House Finance come to order. It's 1:33 p.m. on the 5th of April, 2013. We have members present, Representative Munoz, Representative Holmes, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Guerra, Representative Costello, Stoltz, Co-Chair Osterman, Representative Wilson, Representative Edgman, Representative Thompson, and Vice Chair Newman. We are at full strength. Two bills before us today. For this segment, we are going to adjourn the meeting to call a chair, or a recess to call a chair to give us the opportunity to take up some other legislation before we get to a serious backlog with all the other issues. We have 136 and House Bill 31 before us for this afternoon session. Representative Keller will first present his bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for taking the time to hear my bill. I'm Representative Wes Keller, Representative of House District 7. House Bill 31 requires school districts to create a curriculum segment in the history of American constitutionalism and requires students to complete the curriculum segment as a condition of graduation. The policy decision before you today is whether or not you're willing to vote for an unfunded curriculum mandate on the schools. And I understand that. I have some struggle with that myself. But on this one, I would argue that it is a little bit of a special case. It's already mandated that our schools teach histories and regulations, and this actually just kind of tweaks what happens in American history. It's already an integral part and something that is just presumed that is happening in our schools. Many schools actually, I'm sure, are already in compliance with this mandate, but some are not, I believe, and so there should be no real significant burden on the school districts. In fact, I haven't heard too many complaints. What this is about is American constitutionalism. The reason the word ism is used, it's about the values that are in our Constitution and the documents that were so significant in the forming of our country. And the bill spells out that they're to look at American constitutionalism as defined or as portrayed in the Declaration of Independence, the early state constitution, the Articles of Confederation, the U.S. Constitution, the Federalist Papers, and the Bill of Rights. It's about the values and the principles that are found in those documents, and they are very profound. We have a tendency, I think, to take them for granted now and then, and that's part of the reason why I bring this forward. Actually, those documents were formed in a 15-year period, you know, of our history in the United States, a very short time, and it's turned out, this is a matter of my opinion, is one of the greatest gifts to mankind that's ever happened. American constitutionalism is a statement on human rights that has been, looked at as a standard and a guide for many forms of human government that have happened across the world. Actually, our system is pretty unique. It's a huge statement on the dignity, on human dignity. It starts out, all men are created equal in terms of rights. And it's a unique and a wonderful thing that we're all created equal, and it goes into the rights and the freedom of speech and all those that we tend to sometimes, like I say, take for granted. When I introduced this bill, it was in 2011. It was shortly after that, or just before that, that Hosni Mubarak, remember, in Egypt, was pulled down, and Egypt had to regroup. And if you remember, the military at that time in 2011 came up with a new constitution for Egypt to function with. And that lasted about a year, and then they restructured. And December 26th, just this last year, just before while we were packing up to come back down here, they came up with another new constitution and a new system. Here, March 24th, just a week ago, they're having riots in the streets, people having to resign. That were involved in putting this constitution together. I mean, it's just a struggle. The reason I'm bringing that up, the point is, our values in American constitutionalism give us the ability, as people who understand that, to look at the events that are happening there in Egypt and make decisions. We look at the, for example, the source of human rights. or the source of their autonomy. You know, over there, the only one option there could be is that whatever rights are given to the people, has the source has to be the military or whatever form of government that they, top-down government that they can provide. The contrast in our American constitutionalism system is that our rights are in natural rights. They're, you know, God created them in us. That's the way we look at it, that the value of the fact that we are the source of government and we are the ultimate power behind them. In any other country, the rights that are given are provided by the government. I was reading the China Constitution this morning, just out of interest, and our preamble says... our preamble says we the people. Their preamble gives a little history of China, but then and the last words are, and this constitution will be obeyed by everybody here and define the rights. I mean, it's very different than our approach. Our approach is we the people are in charge, we authorize the authority in government, and those are the kind of things. I'm talking to people I understand that I know the values that I'm talking about, but I just want to point them out because they're so, you know, we tend to not do it enough, I think. We have the freedom of religion. The new Egypt Constitution has a freedom of religion, but it's for the Abrahamic only, Jewish and Christian and Islam. So anything else, not free over there, not no freedom. Well, they use the term freedom of worship. Freedom of expression, really there is none, but they have some words that makes it sound like it, but you look at it and you see there's no limitations, realistic limitations like we have done, like you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. You know, I mean, that concept, it's an expression, and they use the words out of our Constitution, but not the values. You know, I won't go on that. I do want to close. This isn't a problem. I'm not bashing the school districts for not getting the job done. I'll admit that I got lax and I didn't know the values, and I started digging and really enjoying the review. There's a lot of people that see the problem in us not knowing. In Thomas Jefferson, I'm going to use a quote, he said a long time ago, as we work together to advance cost-effective justice, we must remember that the greatest guarantee of a strong future for all three branches of government is a citizenry that understands and embraces the fundamental principles of democracy. So that was, you know, a founding statement. Another comment I want to make, some of you were here when Chief Justice Carpinetti gave his State of the Judiciary speech here. I think it was last year, maybe the year before. But anyway, he says, you know, and he's spent a lot of time on increasing the awareness of students in schools. And the reason he did that is Chief Justice Susan O'Connor has started a curriculum online. I think they call it e-civics. And that's a significant point because this mandate does not require expending a lot of money. It just, you know, there's a lot out there. And O'Connor has provided it. It's online. They can go in and use the curriculum segments online. It's all available. But Chief Justice invited us when he closed his speech. He says, join me in the effort to instill in our young people the same knowledge and respect for our laws and institutions of our country that we are all privileged to share. And that was a closing thought of his speech. Of course, it hit my bill right on. I wanted to go say thank you, sir. But I just wanted to remind you of that. So with that, I would entertain questions, and I would surely encourage or ask for your vote.
We only have one person signed up for testimony. I'd like to go ahead and take that person if we want to find ourselves waiting at the end and not having gotten to. And I see there is, it's not John Boucher. There's another person. Stuart Thompson from Metsu.
Honorable Chairman and committee members, I am Stuart Thompson of District 10, a private Alaska citizen and voter. I'm here to testify concerning, pardon me, this is an emotional thing, concerning HB 31 under the dominant authority of Alaska Constitution, Article 1, Sections 1 and 2. Start of my prepared two-minute testimony.
You don't hold yourself to 2 minutes. If you need a little more, please take. We don't have a prescribed time here.
Well, thank you. I try to comply with the rules to cooperate with you guys. Okay. Per legislative rules, your committee's responsibility is to evaluate the fiscal efficacy of HB 31. The Education Committee has already evaluated and verified its educational efficacy. So is the American Constitutionalism History Literacy Act financially worth making law? I testify as follows that it is. The legislature is charged with competently directing payment of Alaska government bills and intelligently investing public money in constitutionally established avenues like education. Education is an investment because it can return many times the value of what's put into it. One of the greatest returns education delivers is the individual and cooperative ability to resolve problems that hinder quality of life. This bill addresses chronically unresolved problems of our state and nation by targeting the constitutional illiteracy and the lack of discipline at using our political heritage that propagates them. These problems include national bankruptcy, runaway national unemployment, national economic addiction to defense spending that makes military adventurism a necessity, a pathetic loss of ability to harness science to stimulate economic diversity, vulnerability to supercorporation bullying and blackmail because they are too big to truly enforce law on, or to do without, like the oil companies in Alaska. Mediocre skill development of America's people, making corporate, business, and individual welfare a necessity, etc., etc. Constitutionalism, the multipartisan discipline it engenders, and our political heritage represent an overflowing vault of problem-solving riches. Yet this treasure is being treated by our state and nation, using Christ's analogy, like pearls cast before swine. Passing this bill will help create citizens and leaders who are truly capable of ensuring government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish from this earth from the awful terrorism of ignorance. Thank you for your attention. On request, I can testify further about constitutional literacy and repudiation of our political heritage. Good luck on your deliberations.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Any questions from the committee members? Thank you. Thank you for your brevity, but also clarity and substance of your testimony, sir.
You're welcome.
Is there anybody else out there wishing to testify here in Juneau? We'll go ahead and close the public testimony and initiate the discussion. Representative Guerra and
thank
then
you.
Wilson.
Thank you, Representative Keller. Thanks for bringing the bill forward. I'm just looking at page 2 on the Bill of Rights, and it's embarrassing. I'm trying to remember Schoolhouse Rock, which is where we first learned the Constitution.
I'm only a bill.
Do you want to sing the whole thing,
yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go ahead. I got ribbed about that a lot as a kid. So. Please, Representative Gare.
I believe, but I just want you to confirm for sure, or else we can ask somebody else, that every amendment to the Constitution after the original Bill of Rights is considered part of the Bill of Rights. So you have in your bill that they have to teach the Bill of Rights. I want to make sure they teach women's suffrage, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, the right of 18-year-olds to vote, I think, would bring the Constitution alive for kids. But are we 100% sure that my recollection is right, that every subsequent amendment to the Constitution after the original ones are considered parts of the Bill of Rights, or do you know that?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, the Constitution is part of the document that is going to be studied, so they're included along with all the amendments, including the first 10, which are generally the ones called Bill of Rights, and so it certainly doesn't exclude, 11 and on, though that's part of the study.
Fair enough. That's good enough. Thanks.
Representative Wilson and then Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I was looking through the packet, and I was trying to find out what schools already do this and which schools do not.
Representative Keller?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. I don't know that there's an evaluation of what school districts do. And that's I'm glad you asked the question, though, because I want to point out on page 2, line 17, that the superintendent brings this forward, and it's up to the school board to approve the curriculum. It's also up to the school board to decide just what the criteria is used for determining whether or not a student has successfully completed the curriculum segment. So this honors the Alaskan policy that's in place, that we place high respect and trust in our districts to get this stuff done. So, and it, but the answer to your question is, I have no idea what, how many schools do it and how many don't.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? First of all, I'd feel much more comfortable knowing, you know, what districts do and don't, because maybe it's already covered and, you know, they're not remembering. I'm not exactly sure, because I think it's a great idea. I'm just very curious. I mean, we had to do it in school, so I like that. And when you're talking about the statewide, you're talking about this being part of the graduation. So why didn't you go ahead and put this into the graduation test so that it would be the same test for all districts? Because I'm not really sure how you're going to monitor it, whether or not the district writes a test. Does it get sent up to the Department of Education? They say yay or nay, and then it's sent back. Is there a reason why you didn't make it part of the graduation test?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. Yes, we did not get into that because we did not want to. It's bad enough mandating what they do in creating a curriculum segment. It's hard enough. And we just decided not to go that route. So we leave the standards that are to be put in front of the student up to the district. So that is not there intentional.
But Mr. Chair, I mean, I agree with Representative Keller. If we were talking about just the curriculum, but we're actually tying this to graduation, and so you would think we'd want to be consistent so that every school district was giving the same test, and therefore that the curriculum would have to go. I mean, I know we teach to the test because we want them to know certain things. So it just seems like that would make a difference. And I guess if you could just briefly just walk through the process of how you see this happening. You know, does the curriculum only go to the school board, or does it go all the way up to the Department of Education? What the test would look like throughout the different districts, and does that have to be approved by anybody besides the local school board?
Thank you for the question, Representative Wilson. No, there's nothing beyond the school district. The Department of Education is not required to monitor this or keep the standards on it. It is based on a trust in the fact of the history teachers that I know that have a passion for American history and a goodwill response to the bill. I don't know, also, I don't know of any other thing that the legislature has ever legislated that should be part of the high school qualifying exam, specifically as far as curriculum segments. So it would be quite something very different, and we just didn't consider that at all.
Thank you.
Representative Costello.
Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate the sponsor's love of the Constitution and our country's history. We've had many opportunities just to sit down, and I'm fully aware of your position in terms of what's motivating you to introduce this bill, and I share that. My concern is that currently we have government and citizenship standards, content standards, within our schools and teachers, and I have a copy in front of me. And in fact, I'll just read from it. It says, a student who meets the content standard should understand the ideals of this nation as expressed in the Declaration of Independence, the United States Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. And it goes on to talk about Republican form of government, capitalism, again, the U.S. Constitution, including the separation of powers, the executive, legislative, I mean, it goes on and on. One of my concerns is that I do know that these standards can be often introduced to students at any age. And so, and what happens is that as a student moves through their educational process, they may hit some of these things. For example, the co-chair mentioned that he learned songs about the Constitution perhaps in elementary school, and then later on in middle school.
Not going to open my mouth again.
Did I really get a jab in? Okay. and then later on in middle school, we have opportunities where some classroom teachers take students to Washington, D.C. even, and they get a chance to experience our nation's history up front and close and personal. And then as a high school student, they may, in fact, experience it in a different way. And one of the things that I have found in our content standards is that it allows that opportunity for teachers to look at their classroom and the interest perhaps and teach at, you know, at different stages. And my question is, well, do you think that if this becomes a high school graduation requirement that teachers in other, you know, grades just will know that, well, because it's a requirement, we won't be teaching it, and so therefore we'll leave it up to the high school teachers, and we, in fact, will be doing the exact opposite of what the intention of the bill is, which is to grow the understanding of our nation's founding documents.
Representative Costello, through the chair. Thank you. We, in the bill, we anticipate that the multi-grade response to this. There's nothing in here that ties it to the high school other than saying that the superintendent or the school district has to be satisfied that the student has completed a curriculum segment as defined and created by the district. Again, it operates on good faith, and it's, I see it as complementary to the standards very much, and I don't see it in competition.
Representative Costello, then Newman.
Through the chair, and I am aware that the currently the way Alaska statute is that there's it's we base our system on a Carnegie unit, so students receive a certain amount of Carnegie units for the seat time, and so I'm wondering how you see this affecting you know, students in high schools, and also my question I have a question related to Representative Wilson about the exit exam. I mean, it seems to me that if we are going to be requiring districts to write a curriculum and teach that material, which I think is already required, wouldn't we then have to address the exit exam to reflect the information that the students are learning that you feel is added by this bill?
Representative Costello, through the chair. I would, I'm open, of course, you know, the committee can make an amendment to that effect. I didn't go there because I wanted to keep the maximum amount of flexibility and respect there for the local school board, which I think has the biggest interest in making sure that the students are taught this information. And I just don't see the necessary connect to the to the exit exam, but again, that's your option. But did I miss part of your question? If I did, I'm sorry.
Through the chair, I think that this will be affecting schedules within high schools because we'll be adding additional class requirements. I'm just curious if you'd spoken to any districts or principals in regard to that issue.
Representative Costello, again, that's certainly not my intent. There's no hour requirements at all. This is a curriculum segment that is approved by the local school board, and again, if they tie it to extra seat time for the children, that would be the school district choice of the school board.
One final question, Mr.
Jim Costello.
Did you consider when you drafted the bill of having the Division of Teaching and Learning Support in the Department of Education actually create the curriculum? Because the way I read the bill, you would be leaving that up to the districts, and then we would have many districts across the state working on the same effort, which I think would actually cost money because as a former educator, creating curriculum, unless you're going to, I mean, and perhaps identifying curriculum that's written by somebody else, you still would have to purchase it. In fact, that whole issue in schools about the curriculum that the schools are using is very involved. And in the Anchorage School District, we just went through a process of replacing everyday math with Go Math, and so I see this movement into, you know, designing curriculum as something that would actually cost districts, you know, financial resources.
Thank you, Representative Costello, through the chair. I share your appreciation for the amount of work that is into building curriculum segments. I have done it numerous times in my education background. And yes, it can take hours, and to get a good one, it just really is time-consuming. And frankly, that's part of the reason why I didn't go there. I believe some of the districts have adequate curriculum segments already in place, and I believe that's because of the fact that this bill has been on the books since 2011, and I have not gotten a lot of negative feedback from the school district. In fact, I've gotten positive, confirms that, you know, and I just... it's just I don't think a concern. Plus, I pointed out already that there's just tons of curriculum already done, including that currently being promoted by Walter Carpenetti and Susan B. O'Connor online. I believe it's eCivics. I don't have my notes in front of me, and I can't quite pull it back. But the intent is the same as this bill.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, just really quick, can you define what the curriculum segment is actually just and what the intent of having a segment is?
I think the key, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I think the key word there is syllabus, you know, and the syllabus is a description of the, you know, everything, including the measurement of how the student does in the process. And a curriculum segment is a a package that a teacher would put together to accomplish certain goals, in a student's learning experience. In my experience as a teacher, you would start out with, I want the student to walk away with A, B, C, D, and then you go, then you build backwards from that and build lesson plans built on, whatever information you want to bring for your class. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, through the chair. I guess I have some of the same concerns. If you don't know of a school district that currently doesn't do this, then isn't this language sort of superfluous?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. I don't want to, like I say, my intent is not to bash schools in any way. However, I have numerous experiences of meeting school-age kids that maybe don't even know the three branches of government and what have you. So that's just a very my own personal experiences. I've gone and talked to my grandkids and kids, I think that the learning isn't happening, and I think this will help because it raises attention on the values that are found in the founding documents not just the date study and whatever. And so I just believe it'll be a good motivator. When you say I haven't found any schools that aren't doing it, that isn't quite what I said. What I said was that they aren't complaining a lot because many of your good schools, the ones that are engaged anyway, are already doing this and they have it in place. But I don't have a number or a percentage.
Yeah, I didn't, through the chair, I didn't mean to, I was just sort of reiterating questions. I guess the question would be, do you know any school district that currently doesn't teach Articles of Confederation, the state constitutions, Constitutional Congress, Declaration of Independence, Federalist and Anti-Federalist Papers?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, by implication only. The implication being from my personal experiences of running into young people that don't have the knowledge.
I have the Fairbanks North Star Boroughs School District, and they currently do, in their current content standards, do teach constitutionalism. It's highlighted in here. I can make copies for everybody. They talk about the Articles of Confederation writing and ratifying the new Constitution. It's fairly comprehensive, and maybe not every school district goes as in-depth as this, but that's good to know. The other, through the chair, had to deal with the content standards that were presented to us by within our packet from your office, and it really does look like a lot of this is already in current content standards. Follow-up is that the National Center for History in Schools, to address Representative Costello's issue, does also discuss that even in grades 5, kids are taught and exposed to the Articles of Confederation and understanding how to analyze those arguments. In grade 7, they're supposed to teach how to assess the accomplishments and failures of the First Continental Congress. It goes on. It just seems like a lot of this is already covered. With the one problem being that now this is a requirement of graduation. Just to throw it out there.
Yeah, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. I'm not trying to rewrite the content standards. I think it's complementary. I don't. if you don't believe it's complimentary, I guess that's a choice you'll have to make. You know, I think it's a it will enhance the teaching of the values in those early documents, and that's why I passionately bring this bill forward.
Representative Osterman, Munoz, and Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Keller, I like the idea of getting something on the books that forces the issue of teaching American constitutionalism. I am concerned, though, that the bill only deals with districts rather than across the board, because at one point in time in Kodiak, the educational system was in high school, you could turn your homework in as long as you got it in by the end of the quarter, even though it was required 3 weeks or a month before that. Had that same student gone to Anchorage or to Matsu or someplace like that and didn't turn his homework in, automatic failing grade, because the standards are different across the district. And that would be my concern, is that you don't have basic standards that each school district would be teaching each student, so that if there is, and we have a very transient Alaska population, so and I'd be concerned that we ended up with students that would basically fail because they weren't prepared for what they were going into in the next district if they had different standards within the district. So that is a concern that I have, and because I've seen it again with other programs within the schools. So other than that, I think it's a great idea. And the other question deals with the Alaska history, and should the two be tied together in one class type thing, rather than having separate curriculum and separate classes? And
yeah, Representative Osterman, through the chair, I believe that in response to the first thing, the comments there that you were making, I believe that this, by putting it on in statute, gives us the opportunity to check and validate progress and whether or not it happens in the future. And that's one of the things that, is an option for us down the road a couple of years. I guess it's late in the day. The second half of your question, I didn't write the note.
It was basically that trying to make sure that if a student moved across the state, that he had the same standards in the meeting, and also the Alaska history class.
That's right. It does not address the situation of students moving, for sure. And we considered including Alaska history, but in a sense, that's the problem with curriculum mandates anyway. It gets to be a Christmas tree real quick for us, that's why I chose to say very general, very broad, and just say, hey, this is important, and I think it was easily captured in statutory language by just using the word ism on American constitutionalism. It just puts an emphasis on American history that is important, and so we resisted the temptation of adding other things to it.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Representative Keller, I just want to make sure we're on the same page, and I think we are. There's a statement between pages 1 and 2 that obviously reflects the positive aspects of our constitutional history, but that wouldn't prevent a teacher from teaching some of the sort of less proud moments we've had, maybe like the periods where the First Amendment was interpreted to allow you to be sent to jail for protesting the First World War, for example, right? You wouldn't have any problem. This wouldn't prevent us from teaching the ups and downs of the fights during our constitutional history, would it?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, thank you for the question. No, as a matter of fact, that's what it's all about. I mean, the critical thinking aspect, that we would bring to the students by teaching them the values that are revealed easily, obviously, ones we live by in the Constitution, gives them guidelines for critical thinking on what's right and what's wrong in terms of human government. It would be crazy not to. No teacher could resist the temptation of using a teachable moment, looking at history and then comparing it with the values of these early documents.
Thanks. And then through the chair, just one other question. I'm just looking at section B on page 2 of page 25, and I have an easy language change if it is a problem for folks. But I don't know how you measure. This is going to be inside probably an American history course or some similar course. And so I don't know how you measure, you know, let's say somebody gets a B in that American history course. How do you measure whether they completed the curriculum segment described in Section A? I mean, you wouldn't want to have a separate test segment, would you? I mean, wouldn't completion of that course that the American history, that the constitutional part is part of, be good enough? So you take an American history course, you complete it. Inside that American history course, there was a discussion of the Constitution. You wouldn't want to have like a separate disqualifying parameter from graduation based on that part of the course, would you? I mean, or would you?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, no. That's all left up to the local governing body of the local district. And I, again, believe that they will operate on this largely in good faith. And when they make a determination on what the criteria is, it means that they have successfully completed. That's what it will be. It has. I shudder at us trying to write the standards because I was involved, you know, in the process of that several times, and that is not the intent of this bill. The intent of the bill is to leave that to the local district.
Just, Mr. Chair, very briefly on that.
Gary.
So you'd have no problem if it was just clarified to say something like, complete the course in which this curriculum was
about
contained.
Would you have a problem?
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to ask the question, too. Would you have a problem if it was clarified to say that the student had to complete the course in which this curriculum was contained?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, my first reaction is negative. Completing a course sounds like seat time to me. Completing a curriculum satisfactory is something completely different, and I, you know, that's just my knee jerk. I hadn't thought about it.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Representative Keller. Representative Keller, there's folks like you and I and Representative Stoltz and many others who have fought very hard for the rights of homeschool parents to teach their kids in a more open environment. My concern that I can see with this as a homeschool dad and is some of the programs that are out there allow parents to choose their curriculum. We buy our curriculum based on the fact that it is sold under pretenses that it meets certain grade level standards, and those standards are set by the Department of Education. But we have the right as parents to choose the books that we buy and that we use. I think I see a situation here where we would have to now require homeschool parents to get that curriculum approved by the school district prior to using those programs. Is that right or wrong, or how have you dealt with that?
Representative Newman, through the chair, I think you're talking about the homeschool support programs, the public school homeschool support programs, and in those cases, yes, all the curriculum of the students has to be approved by the local school board through which the money goes to the homeschool support programs. That's been very definitely established in regulation, and so I would assume that for any public school, that's the curriculum that would be used would need to be approved by the school district. Just like, even though you choose your own books, Representative Newman, the curriculum and the process is approved by the school board in the regulations now in that type of a school.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keller, I believe when we were with the IDEA program, which is different than the MATSU program does approve of those books. the IDEA program, which is the largest homeschool program in the state with 3,500 plus students. And I think it's one of the largest because it allows the parents to choose that curriculum. I don't believe that the school board does approve that curriculum, and I think a lot of parents are attracted to that one, CyberLinks, and some of the others like that, because they have that freedom of choice. So I don't think that they do have to have the school board currently approve those books, because with 3,600 students and the parents' ability to choose those curriculum, as long as they're grade appropriate level, I think that would be quite a task for the school board to have to try and go through each one of those and decide whether that met your standard here.
Representative Newman, through the chair, it is a big task, and I believe that they do it. And I also, my grandkids are currently enrolled in IDEA. It's a great program, and it's a process, you know, that is imposed on the local school districts that they have to approve the curriculum. And the reason that I speak pretty confidently about it is that a couple years ago there was a lot of debate on this issue, and the question is how could the school board approve curriculum that included religious books, and because the separation of church and state, and the way they changed that, that's part of the reason why I'm quite confident that there's some process in place by which the school board approves curriculum for the homeschool students.
Thank you. I think we're probably at a point where we have some issues to resolve. I'm getting messages from members. There's some issues they'd like to examine. Folks that have suggested language changes, why don't we work through my office, and the designee would be Mr. George, and we'll in turn work with the sponsor's office. We'll try to see what we can resolve. If we can't resolve those through a proposed committee substitute, if we bring this back up, which is, we'll do our best. There's always the amendment process if we don't reach an agreement with what your goal is, and that says per the way this committee works, an open dialogue. I'll just leave as today. I am a huge advocate of better knowledge curriculums, but I also know what my position is here. I don't have the same role as an elected local school board, which sets curriculum, or the state board of education, which is set up to approve the curriculum. I've almost been been incredibly consistent in opposing whether it was even to mandating soda pop machines. I think a school board is able to make that decision, not the legislature. To one of my passions, Alaska history, opposing my good friends and establishing that by statute and directing them to the school board. I think this would have sailed out here if this was a resolution to the Board of Education reflecting the will of this body. That's just my personal position. I don't speak for anybody else on the committee. No diminution of the good efforts and the passion you have on this. It's just it's not more than process. I think the legislature has a pretty shoddy record of getting involved in setting curriculum and micromanagement of the school with the best efforts and intentions. So that. I think, Representative Wilson, you want to drag us on? Go ahead.
Just one thing. I could do it myself, but if Representative Keller could just find out what districts already do this and what districts don't, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I was trying to, we had guests from Anchorage that have flown up here. I want to make sure we have time for that presentation. So we will set this aside and we will make our best efforts. Members, please, again, work through my office, and the designee is Mr. George. Do our best, and I know you are very interested, in trying to navigate this through the last parts of the process. So knowing that I'm going to be as helpful, even I will vote to move this bill out, notwithstanding my opposition, but you have to garner a lot of other support here as well, Representative Keller. So I think we know the dictates for our directions. Representative Keller.
I just want to say thank you to the committee. I know it's a busy time of the year, and I you know, I just also want to say that I'm committed. I would really like you to consider this bill further, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your time here, sir. We'll look forward to seeing you again if it's we can. We will take a couple minutes at ease to let transition to the next presenters. As finance come back to order after a brief recess, we have roughly the same people, give or take a person, back from our full strength. It's given the climate we're in, talking budgets and major documents of fiscal policy and direction, it's a real privilege to have some of the leaders on economic thought here, Mr. Keithley and Mr. Goldschmidt and whoever that other lady is now. And Representative Millett for bringing... Millett. There's another Millett. I know. here to discuss this. It's a very timely timely subject. This committee has a strong interest in fiscal policy. We have a subcommittee that is chaired by Representative Costello and has my co-chair on as a member as well as some others on this committee. So we appreciate having this instrument of direction and discussion before us today. With that preface, we'll turn the it will be your show, and I know you have one that may be up to an hour, so we will hold questions and let you get through your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman Stoltz and members of the Finance Committee. It's a pleasure to be here for the first time. I haven't had a bill that has had a fiscal note. I take great pride in that. This bill before you, House Bill 136, addresses something that I think this committee, more than any committee in the legislature, is fully aware of, is that this year we'll be in deficit spending. If you look at the 10-year fiscal plan put together by OMB, you'll see in year 2020 we also go into a deficit spending based on that fiscal plan. And just to make a note, the 10-year fiscal plan that we have before us, it doesn't take into account SB 21, which is the oil tax reduction bill. So with that in mind, HB 136 is actually the genius of Dr. Goldsmith. And over the summer, I spent some time with Brad Keithley talking about, what the fiscal health of the state was, what we were really doing, and how we do our budgets. And it seems every year, as you know, we base our budgets off of revenues, not what's necessarily responsible spending for the state of Alaska. And that bill is what is the recognition of that is talking about a more holistic look at our budgets based on a couple different levers in the state. And so with that, I would just hope that we could take a look at how we make our budgets up, what we inventory, what we take into account, and then not always base our budgets off of how much revenue comes in and how much revenues go out. I think we're going to see a substantial change in the revenue, which doesn't account for not only the tax change that we're going through, which I'm hopeful will happen, but the decline in TAPS, and that our economy is based on basically one revenue stream, which is oil and gas. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to the experts, and I just really appreciate you taking the time today to listen to what they have to say and what this bill attempts to do. It's not a mandate on spending. What it is it's a recommendation from the governor's office on how much we really can sustainably spend from year to year and make sure that the budgets will go long into the future for my grandchildren and my grandchildren's grandchildren. So with that, I'll pass it on to you.
In addition to that, I think there was a revenue forecast for a spring forecast, which is not as rosy as the fall forecast. So I'm sure that'll get worked in as well. Who is going to begin?
I think it's my turn next. I'm Scott Goldsmith. I'm a professor emeritus at the University of Alaska in Anchorage in economics. My role today, and thank you for the opportunity to come before you again and speak. My role today is quickly to provide some background material that will help you to understand what HB 31 is trying to accomplish. And my presentation is primarily based on the presentation that I made in much greater detail a couple of weeks ago to House and Senate Finance, and I think most of you were at that presentation. So I don't have to provide a lot of detail, but I'm certainly happy to answer questions. But the state fiscal plan that I'm talking about here is really a roadmap for the future. And it's a roadmap that would help us as a state to live within our means and have the resources we need to continue to provide the public goods and services that we've come to expect for our children and our grandchildren. And I think by now we all know what the problem is that the state faces. We're on an unsustainable spending growth path. And this looks at that problem through the lens of the state general fund looking forward. And the black line, of course, is the growth in state general fund spending. The green area is the revenue source that we primarily depend upon today, 95% of our general fund revenues, and that's oil revenues from taxes and royalties. And what we see moving forward is that those two lines diverge. Spending continues to go up. Revenues from petroleum are going down. And what is preventing a gap from opening up in the short term is the red area, which is the revenues that we have available currently from our financial reserves, specifically the statutory budget reserve and the constitutional budget reserve. And you can see in this diagram that we're able to fund growing expenditures through the use of reserves for a limited number of years, but at some point those reserves disappear. And if we're not thinking forward, that will come as a shock. It could be a $4 billion shock. It could be a $5 billion shock to the state budget in a single year. And we have been unable to identify other sources of revenue to take the place of declining petroleum revenues in the long run. This graph shows revenues from new oil, revenues from gas, and you can see that they're not sufficient to offset declining petroleum revenues in the face of continued growth in state spending. And what happens when the what I call the fiscal gap opens up is not only that the state's ability to fund public expenditures is constrained, but this additionally puts a very significant strain on the economy, because we know that state government spending is such an important element of driving the state's economy, both the capital and the operating budgets. And what's particularly troubling is that, unlike the last recession that we suffered back in the 1980s, this would not be most likely a temporary setback for the state. As we can see, that in the absence of other revenue sources, we would essentially be riding the oil decline curve down through time. And so we'd be looking at a permanent contraction, if you will, not only of our ability to spend on government programs, but of the economy as well. So, what's the solution? How can we avoid the crash and the continuing ride down the decline curve? Well, I would suggest that we can do it by changing how we think about oil revenues. We should recognize and manage that our petroleum wealth is really a depleting asset that belongs to all Alaskans, not only those of us here today, but those who will be here in the future. And if we do that, then the way to manage that asset is straightforward and relatively simple. First of all, we have to determine what the value of that asset is. How much is it worth? Secondly, how much can we spend from that asset without depleting it? And finally, how can we invest the corpus of that asset for maximum return? So, if we want to determine what the value of our petroleum asset is, it's really composed of two components that, by my estimate, total about $150 billion today. And of course, this estimate is based on a lot of assumptions, because we're looking not only at what we have today in the bank, but also the value of our assets, our petroleum assets, that's still in the ground. Well, the value of the money that we have in the bank is really part of our petroleum wealth, because it's the share of petroleum revenues already collected that we've converted into financial asset. And depending on what day of the week it is and what the stock market is doing, that the value of that money in the bank could be $60 billion, could be $61 billion. The permanent fund corpus has been enjoying a run-up in recent weeks because of the stock market. So the value of our asset in the bank is probably worth a little bit more than $60 billion today. But at the start of the fiscal year, $60 billion was a good estimate. That's a combination of the permanent fund balance, the constitutional budget reserve, and the statutory budget reserve. Now, there are other pots of money floating around that I'm sure you're better aware of than I am, because I don't spend my time down here in the halls. But the big financial assets that are available to spend government total about $60 billion. The other asset that we have is the value of the revenues from oil and gas still in the ground that we can expect to collect in future years. And I value that at $89 billion. How do I come up with that estimate? Well, it's based on a lot of assumptions that I don't have time to go into. A lot of them are described in the web note that I think you may have seen, which I think was passed out at my previous presentation. Now, that $89 billion is not just the accumulation of future revenues from oil and gas, but rather it's the value today, if we could capitalize, if we convert all of those future revenues to a value today. So basically, it's a net present value calculation of future revenues. That's exactly the kind of exercise that a business person would do if they were trying to value an asset, put a value today on an asset that would be generating over future years a stream of revenues. That's what that asset would be worth today. So that's my estimate of that. And that's the combination of known conventional oil, and that projection comes primarily from the Alaska Department of Revenue, $67 billion. And other oil and gas.
Representative Edgman?
Yeah, I guess I'm just a little confused by this presentation because, in all due respect, Dr. Goldsmith, harkening back to one of your earlier presentations a couple years ago, a third of Alaska spending comes from the federal government. So I'm not getting that out of this presentation. We've already had this presentation, if I'm not mistaken. So, I mean, it maybe put me back on track because I'm wondering where all this. Where we're going with the focus on the oil and gas aspect of it all.
Yeah. The focus of this presentation is just provide some background for the rationale for HB 31. 136. I'm sorry.
And I think it's easy to have everything evolving around our oil policy and tax policy, but this is probably a much larger concept is how we.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I would hope we'd factor that in because, you know, in as much as depleting oil and gas reserves are a tremendous problem, and I'm there to recognize that it's certainly going to be a critical policy call we're going to have to make shortly, but on the federal end of things as well, I mean, we're facing a pretty uncertain future too, and that's a big chunk of what happens in Alaska as well. So I just don't want that to go unnoticed.
Yeah. I would certainly agree with you 100%. And you know, what we're looking at here, essentially, and you'll see in a minute, is our ability to fund the state general fund. The problems that may arise with declines in federal grant assistance, both capital and operating, is an additional issue. I don't want to get into all of these issues today. I want to concentrate on just this one if we can. So, the estimate of the value of our petroleum asset, $150 billion, $149 billion, and the question is: so, assuming that we manage that asset for maximum return, we manage it reasonably. Both the financial assets and the oil that's still in the ground, The question is, how much can we draw from that asset every year? How much can we spend and still maintain, sustain its value for future generations of Alaskans? And the calculation is, arithmetically, it's pretty simple. We take the value of the nest egg each year, and this is looking at fiscal year 2014. Value of the nest egg, $149 billion. Multiply that by the draw rate, which I've estimated at 4% annually in real dollars, real percent, real draw rate, and that is a 5% real rate of return, which is what the permanent fund targets as a rate of return, minus 1% reinvested to recognize that the number of Alaskans is growing at about 1% a year and has been probably since Alaska became a state. So if we're going to maintain the value of our nest egg for future generations of Alaskans, we have to let that nest egg grow a little bit each year to reflect growing number of Alaskans. So 4% of $149 billion is $6 billion. That, then, is our estimate of the maximum sustainable yield draw from our petroleum nest egg this year. Now, most people tend to think of how much, or ask the, put the question in terms of how much can we spend out of the state general fund. And in order to come up with that calculation, you have to make two adjustments to the $6 billion. First of all, you have to net out the permanent fund dividend account, because the permanent fund dividend account obviously is coming out of the value of our petroleum nest egg. This year, that will be about $1 billion. And then, secondly, add in the share of general fund spending that is financed from non-petroleum revenues. And this year, that will be about $500 million. So if you take the $6 billion, subtract $1 billion for the permanent fund dividend, and add a $500 million for non-petroleum general fund revenues, then we come up with the $5.5 billion figure, or target, if you will, for general fund maximum sustainable yield. And what that is the amount that we could spend under current conditions out of the general fund this year without passing a financial or fiscal burden on to future generations. And that fiscal burden, if we spent at a higher rate than that, would be in the form of a reduction in the size of our nest egg, or you could think of it as a transfer to future generations of a tax burden, or a reduction in the ability of future generations to spend public revenues at the rate that we're spending them. So that would be the maximum sustainable yield for 2014. If we were to get on that path, then over time, what would happen is that, over time, what we expect to happen is that the value of oil in the ground, oil and gas in the ground, will decline, because we'll be producing the oil and gas. It won't be in the ground anymore. Okay? We don't have as much value of oil and gas in the ground today as we had 20 years ago before, 30 years ago before Prudhoe Bay started production. So the share of our nest egg held as revenues, future revenues from oil and gas still in the ground, would be going down. But offsetting that would be an increase over time in the value of our financial assets, because of the reinvestment of a share of our current petroleum revenues into the financial asset, and a reinvestment of a share of the financial assets themselves. So taken together, the value of the nest egg would increase over time. This graph shows the growth in inflation-adjusted dollars. And if you look closely, you can see that it would be increasing at the rate of 1% a year, which is the rate of population growth, so that the per capita value of the nest egg in real terms would remain constant over time. And with that, we would have an increasing ability over time to fund the state general fund. This graph on the left is another version of a projection of general fund spending, and it summarizes the spending in three categories, really. The black is projected petroleum revenues. The blue is revenues from financial assets. And the red, you can't see the colors. The red is non-petroleum revenues. And because the size of the nest egg is growing at 1% in real terms a year, the size of the draw available to fund the general fund is growing at the same rate. So this diagram shows how the general fund can grow, not in real terms, but in nominal terms. And I've added inflation back into this because most people don't think in inflation-adjusted dollars. So these are nominal dollars. And what this shows is that under this trajectory, the amount of money from the nest egg would be growing at 4% a year, okay, which would just offset inflation and population increase. Now, this is not a suggestion of a spending cap. Rather, it's a suggestion of a target or a spending cap from the nest egg, from our petroleum asset. So you can see at the top there the non-petroleum revenues. It's a little bar at the top. As I mentioned before, it's only 5% of total general fund revenues today. If there are additional expenditures that are reasonable to be made, there's no reason why non-petroleum revenues can't be expanded through taxation or some other means to provide for those additional goods and services. So this is just a target for our petroleum asset. And as you can see, compared to the sort of business as usual diagram that I started with, there's no fiscal gap here. You could extend this sustainable growth, general fund growth graph out as far as you want, and it would continue to be viable. So that's as far as we've taken the analysis so far, but it's time to start thinking about implementation. And here are four basic components of implementation of this kind of a strategy. The first one is to manage our financial assets for maximum long-term return. We're sort of doing that already. Okay. The second is the one that we're talking about here today, and that we're proposing in HB 136. That is to establish a monitoring system to track the nest egg value, the size of the nest egg, set the maximum sustainable yield target, and track our progress moving towards that target of sustainability, and if possibly to track how staying on that target over time. In addition to that, implementation obviously would require a gradual transition to a general fund maximum sustainable yield level, and proactively participating in the management of petroleum in the ground for maximum return. But those are discussions for another day.
So with that introduction, let me turn it over to Brad Keatley, and he will talk more specifically to the elements in this proposed bill.
The record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Brad Keatley. I'm a partner and the co-head of the Oil and Gas Group at Perkins Coie, which is a law firm with Anchorage offices and offices elsewhere. My purpose here today is really to explain 136 and what 136 does in specific. Let me say at the outset, though, that the reason that I've spent so much time on this issue and dealing with...
Can you describe a little more your background? I think you're an attorney is kind of an incomplete curriculum vitae.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman.
I'm not trying to be facetious. I think a lot of us know you in a much broader, as a commentator, sometimes critic, sometimes...
Sometimes ally.
Sometimes ally.
So my background is basically 35 years in dealing with oil issues and dealing with financial issues and dealing with investor issues, investor in the oil patch. I got my law degree from the University of Virginia Law School. From there, I then spent 2 years in the Pentagon in the Secretary of the Air Force General Counsel's office, where I learned more about government in a two-year period than I think anybody should. It was a great postgraduate education course. From there, I went to a regional law firm in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I practiced for 6 years, handled entirely oil issues during those 6 years. I got to know the oil patch from the ground up. I did stand-up title opinions out in western Oklahoma, and I also dealt with some sophisticated tax issues that existed in the oil industry in the late 70s and early 1980s. In 84, I became general counsel of what was then the third largest gas company in the United States. I continued in that for 6 years. My boss at the time was a guy by the name of Mac McClarty, who you may recall then became the chief of staff to Bill Clinton. When Bill Clinton was president, basically, Mac became chief of staff because he's the only one who could get along with Bill and Hillary at the same time.
Childhood friend, he probably had some good.
Childhood, very good, Mr. Chairman. Those 6 years spent at the company was called ARCLA. It had formerly been Arkansas Louisiana Gas Company and then was consolidated. The name was shortened to ARCLA. Those 6 years were an excellent understanding of, provided an excellent understanding of how to deal with how companies look at oil and gas issues. I was in the boardroom, and I was responsible for advising with respect to investments that our company made in oil and gas properties and development of oil and gas properties. It was also an excellent insight into politics. Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas during those 6 years. Hillary was one of our outside counsel, being a general counsel of the largest utility in the state, we went through some political cycles as well. From there, I moved to a firm that now goes by the name of Jones Day. I spent 18 years there. Jones Day is one of the largest law firms in the United States. One of the largest law firms in the world. The firm has 26 offices spread throughout the world, has 2,600 lawyers, advisor to major corporations. I was at times the head of the oil and gas group with that firm, and I spent a lot of years advising and talking to investors, again, in the oil industry about investments not only in the United States but globally. And then after that 18 years, I moved. In 1993, I started working Alaska issues with Jones Day. Probably for the first 5 years, I spent 1 week every 3 months in Alaska dealing with Alaska issues. In 2000, we then gained UNICAL as a client, and I spent a lot of time on Cook Inlet issues, spent more time here. The last 5 years before I moved up here in 2008, I probably was here 3 weeks out of four a month dealing with issues. So my experience is entirely with oil and gas. It's entirely with dealing with investor issues, entirely dealing with fiscal issues related to oil and gas. And has spanned not only issues in the lower 48, but globally, and with concentration over the last several years in Alaska. Does that help?
I think it providing the background, and I don't think that was That was very descriptive. I appreciate knowing more about you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I come to this issue is, frankly, it comes from two standpoints. If we go back, if you don't mind, if we go back to the first slide. Thank you. I look at this slide, and I see two problems. One is I see a problem related to future generations of Alaskans. And I see a situation in which our generation is going to do fine up until about 2023. But then I see a situation in 2023 where Representative Costello's two kids and the other kids around this table are not going to do fine. We're going to have a revenue stream that's much smaller. And in order to maintain the same quality of life that we have, they're either going to have to tax themselves or they're going to have to accept the fact that the role of state government is going to be much smaller than what we've enjoyed over this period. And the second reason that this slide motivates me is I've been around oil and gas investors a lot in my life, and I know that one of the things they look at in making long-term investments, which are the kind of investments that we want to attract to this state, in making long-term investments is they look not only at the tax structure today and indeed the tax structure tomorrow, but they look at the fiscal situation of the state and look at where the state is headed, where the state's headed fiscally, and look at potential problems in the state's fiscal situation going forward and how that may, and then think about how that may translate into additional taxes or changes in taxes for them. This chart in particular troubles me because when an oil and gas investor looks at the long term, for a major investment, they're looking at 10, 15, 20 years. That's the life of the revenue stream that they're counting on. And if you look at this chart and look at where that fiscal cliff is, it comes right in the middle of major investments that we want to start attracting to this state. So the concern I have is not only for what we're leaving our children and our grandchildren, but also what we're doing to ourselves in terms of being attractive to long-term, large-scale investment with the fiscal policy that we've got in this state. What attracts me to the sustainable budget that Dr. Goldsmith is talking about...
Is that going back to, back to your concern about investment policy?
It is.
The taxpayer that's got the yellow, the orange jacket with the 90% coverage target, is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly right, Mr. Chairman, because we're concerned about... those are sophisticated investors. And that are making major long-term investments. They look at where this state has derived its revenue currently. They look at the future and where the state may derive revenue in the future. And frankly, there aren't that many places that you can derive revenue in the state. Dr. Goldsmith has done other studies that talk about the amount of tax we'd have to put on fish or the amount of tax we'd have to put on gold.
I can recite them all.
and there simply isn't. There simply aren't sources sources of revenue that you can go to the tax that sustain the type of spending and the type of state government that we have created the expectation for with our past and current practice. So what attracts me to the sustainable budget approach is that it's essentially a retirement account. I mean, we're essentially saying that we recognize the revenue stream that we're getting from oil today is not only for our benefit, the benefit of our generation, but needs to be for the benefit of future generations. And just like your income, Mr. Chairman, and my income, we look at our income and we say, look, it's not only going to sustain us during the next several years, but it's got to sustain us in our retirement as well. And the way we do that with our income is we take a portion of it, set it aside, put it in a retirement account, and count on it when we get to our retirement to produce revenue, to produce income that we then can use to sustain our living past the point of retirement. That's basically what the sustainable approach that Dr. Goldsmith has outlined. It allows Alaska to take from its current revenue stream, put a portion of it into a retirement account, the nest egg, as Dr. Goldsmith refers to it, and then provides the opportunity when we get to the point where oil revenues can no longer sustain us as a state, provides a revenue stream from the fiscal side that enables us to continue to have a fairly good standard of living. Just like you and I, with our retirement accounts, Mr. Chairman, we need to recognize that while we have income, while we're working and we have an income stream, that we need to be putting aside a portion of it into a retirement account. And what Dr. Goldsmith is outlining in his approach is an approach that takes a portion of that, it recognizes what the assets are today, recognizes that we need to be putting a portion of it aside into a retirement account, and then drawing from that retirement account, as you can see on this bar beginning out around the 2019 time frame, drawing on that retirement account, the fiscal side of that retirement account, the earnings side of that retirement account as we go forward. So that builds a sustainable long-term fiscal environment for this state. It's not that we have to increase taxes at some point. It's not that we have a fiscal cliff at some point. It's not that we have to look for other sources of revenue at some point. We build a legacy for our children and our grandchildren. We build a legacy for the future of this state that is self-perpetuating and continues to produce income for the long term. In order to do that, though, we have to reduce our level of take currently. Just like in Bristol Bay, sometimes you have to reduce your level of take of fish in order to ensure that there's going to be fish in the future. We have to reduce our level of take currently in order to take a portion of the assets and put them aside. So
very astute. You didn't talk about Cook Inlet, so I'll give you kudos for that.
So what 136 does is a very simple first step. 136 is not a mandate. It doesn't tell this committee or the governor or anybody in the state how to spend money. It doesn't instruct them with respect to spending levels. It simply starts providing an information stream that this committee and other committees can use to evaluate where we are in developing a sustainable budget going forward. And it does that in a very, very simple way. Let me first mention, Mr. Chairman, that the first, House Bill 136, as introduced, was a first stab at trying to do the calculation. And it was a good stab, but it wasn't a perfect stab. So you should have in front of you a blank CS that proposed as a substitute for original HB 136 that does a much better job of articulating how the calculation should be done.
Representative Holmes. Yeah, but we'll have that staff, if we have that, can you pass it out? My apologies.
Well, I've actually got a chart that does this. Can you just page me over to that? There you go. Thank you. So what the blank CS does, Mr. Chair, is basically go through Dr. Goldsmith's calculation and result in a number that is the maximum sustainable yield number on an annual basis. And it puts it in this context. Every year, the governor does a 10-year fiscal plan as part of the budget. And that provides basic information that this body and the other body then use to develop the budget, and the governor uses to develop his budget as well. It's the basic set of fiscal information that is used in the legislature to try to develop budgets. All this bill does is include as part of the 10-year fiscal plan, require the governor include as part of the 10-year fiscal plan, the calculation of what a maximum sustainable yield budget would look like, what the number would be for each year about what the legislature should be spending to stay on the maximum sustainable yield track. It is, if the number were calculated this year, it would be the $5.5 billion that Dr. Goldsmith talked about during his presentation. So the purpose, the 136 amends the statute dealing with the 10-year fiscal plan, inserts a Section 5, which is another requirement of what is to be included in the 10-year fiscal plan, and simply requires that as part of the information provided by the 10-year fiscal plan, that the governor provide the information about what the maximum sustainable yield would be, calculated in the way Dr. Goldsmith has outlined. To be very simple about it, it takes, as Dr. Goldsmith outlines in today and in his paper, it takes the following this slide down from the top. It takes the permanent fund balance, adds to it the CBR balance, adds to it the SBR balance. Those are the financial assets that Dr. Goldsmith talked about. Then it adds the value of petroleum in the ground, which is the net present value of our future earnings stream off of oil as calculated in the manner that Dr. Goldsmith has outlined. That equals the nest egg. And the nest egg is our asset, our retirement account that is going to produce revenue for us in the future. Multiply the nest egg by 4%, which is the yield off the retirement account that we're expecting to use. That equals the maximum sustainable yield, or the sustainable budget number. You add to that non-petroleum general fund revenues, which is what Dr. Goldsmith described during his discussion. You subtract from that the permanent fund dividend, again, which is what Dr. Goldsmith described during his discussion, and that is the final number that you get, the sustainable yield number. That is the number, looking at the chart, that is the number that comes, that this year would come to $5.5 billion, and is the number that would be the number if we spent it now, say, based upon what we know now, based upon the projection of the future petroleum stream, based upon the level of the SBR and the CBR and the permanent fund. That is the number that if we spend it now, save the remainder, that's the number that we could have in perpetuity as a revenue stream, not only for this generation of Alaskans, but for future generations of Alaskans, and avoid the fiscal cliff. So all that this bill is doing is requiring the calculation of that number on an annual basis, require that it be provided as part of the 10-year plan, that then will enable the legislature to take that into account in setting its future budgets with the knowledge of, you know, if we're going over the sustainable budget level, then we're borrowing from future generations. We're taking from future generations. We're making their life worse. If we're on the sustainable budget number, then future generations are being treated in the same way as the current generation, and we don't have a fiscal cliff out there that we're going to have to face. So that's the purpose of 136, simply to require a calculation as part of the 10-year plan to be included. Frankly, then that means in future sessions, when you talk about budgets, we will have a number that we can talk about. That is the sustainable yield number. It won't be a number that we have to calculate through ICER annually and put it out in a web note and then try to get everybody aware of. It will be a number that comes into the legislature from OMB as part of the 10-year plan that we then can talk about whether we ought to follow that number for that year or we ought to deviate from that number and the consequences to future generations if we do deviate from that number. Mr. Chairman, that completes our presentation.
Thank you very much. A couple of quick questions in relationship to what's going on in the current decline in TAPS. Worst case scenario, the legislature doesn't change things and that decline stays there. Price of the amount of natural gas in the lower 48 right now, which they keep on talking about, 100-year supply down there, and the net value of that is driving down a value, I think, across the world in reference to natural gas. So worst case scenario, we don't have a natural gas line. How does that play within all of your computing? I mean, you must be able to stick that in there and say, okay, we'll just live off of our savings. I mean, I don't understand.
The calculation of the value of oil and gas still in the ground that I did includes a component for marketing our natural gas. The assumptions that are built into this are that that won't happen for quite a few years, and that it won't be the kind of fiscal bonanza that some people expect. For those two reasons, and those are my assumptions, but for those two reasons, the value of that in today's terms, the discounted net present value, is relatively modest. Okay. Now, if, and I expect that they will, conditions in oil and gas markets will continue to evolve and change, and those will impact the value that we place on the oil and gas that we have, that's the revenues from that that's still in the ground. But I think one of the advantages of looking at our fiscal situation from this perspective is that those kinds of changes have a relatively modest impact on the calculation of the maximum sustainable yield general fund spending level today. In other words, if we netted any revenues from commercialization of gas out of this calculation, it would, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it would drop our maximum sustainable yield calculation maybe to $5 billion in 2014. I'm just guessing, but that's my sense is that the maximum sustainable yield number, well, I know that it's not that sensitive to the assumptions that we make about future oil and gas revenues. But another advantage of this calculation is that it forces us to think critically and consistently about what the future oil and gas revenues are that we're likely to collect in future years, rather than relying solely on what now are just, as far as I can tell, speculations beyond what the Department of Revenue presents in their revenue forecast, which only goes out, as I recall, for a 10-year period, which serendipitously, I don't know what the opposite of serendipitous is, but serendipitously is just about the time that we would be running out of our financial reserves from the CBR and the SBR. So they don't really give us a clue as to what happens in year 11.
Just to make note, in the 10-year forecast that OMB does, they don't take into consideration gas in their calculations. It's based on oil and price and oil production, so they don't assume that we'll have marketed gas at that point in time either through that 10 years. So that's another assumption that they use, they don't use also.
Questions? Representative Holmes, Kawasaki Kira.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. I'm sorry if these are less informed than they could be, since we just saw the language for the first time. It doesn't include the, and I like where we're going, and I think this is a very, very useful thing. So I want to start by saying I'm very much on board with where this is going, and I think it's a great tool and something we should be looking at. But a couple of questions on the sort of mechanics of it. It doesn't include in the here anything about, it talks about non-oil general fund money, but it doesn't talk about oil revenue for that year. Is it suggested, because obviously we've got state income coming in, and you've got, you know, the $500 million in non-oil and gas, and then you've got all the rest of it. Is that for that year that you're calculating? Is the idea that that's somehow wrapped up in the net present value calculation, or should that be in here as well?
It's in there in the form of the first year of revenues in the net present value calculation.
Okay.
Okay.
It's definitely in there.
I figured you hadn't just missed that.
It should be. It's maybe a little unclear.
You're smarter than I am on these things. I figured that there was a good answer.
That's a good, okay. Good point of clarification.
Okay, and a couple more, Mr. Chairman, if I may follow up. When we're looking at line 22 and 23 on page 2, we're talking about the statutory budget reserve fund. I understand on the lines ahead when we talk about the principle of the permanent fund and the principle of the budget reserve fund, because my understanding is in the Constitution they pretty clearly, and I haven't gone back to double check, but they pretty clearly separate out what's principal versus what's interest. I'm not sure, and I've just been flipping through the statutes here on the statutory budget reserve fund, and it's not clear to me from just a quick look at the language that they as clearly designate the difference between principal, what exactly the principal is in the statutory budget reserve fund, and so I'm not sure if that's something you've looked at.
It's intended, Representative Holmes, through the chair, it's intended to be the balance of the statutory budget reserve. As well as, frankly, the balance of the permanent fund and the balance of the constitutional budget reserve. Because what we're doing is we're viewing those as our retirement account, again, to continue my analogy, viewing those as our retirement account that we put into retirement that are going to produce revenue in the future. So it's the balance of those. It's not intended to be just a slice of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the appropriate time, maybe we'll look into making that, just to be clear. And just one more sort of general comment that I struggle with constantly, and this is more of a philosophical thing that I just want to throw out there. I'm very, very on board with doing this in a sustainable manner. I think we've been we're not at a sustainable spot right now, and I think you're going to find pretty broad agreement around the table about that. I look at, I'm trying to remember which page the chart's on. I think it's a couple slides. Maybe, I don't know. This one. No, it's not that one. Sorry. The next one after that. Okay, so looking at the big chart there about going out, and this is sort of the plan, right? The big graph there is this plan. And I love the idea of being able to make sure that we're taking care and we have sustainable services going forward. At the same time, I worry about the whole idea of sort of a trust fund society. And when you get to the point, I just struggle with that a little bit, about what it means going into the future to have a society where, looking at that, the vast majority of what you are using to pay for government comes strictly out of things that out of a savings account being a trust fund. So it's just a philosophical thing I just wanted to throw out there.
I think that is an important consideration and a concern. to the extent that our revenues come more and more from financial assets, just the need to spend more time managing those financial assets in a way to maximize return and to make sure the financial assets will be managed in a way where they'll be there when our children and grandchildren need them will be more and more of a challenge. But to get to your question of trust fund babies, you know, I'm worried about that,
and
too.
And to be clear, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that either the sponsor or either of the presenters are advocating this as an economic plan.
Except that if you think about the fiscal past of Alaska, we already are trust fund babies because we've been living for 35 years off of the assets from the generation of petroleum. And we've paid no taxes. So to my mind, that's sort of a definition of a trust fund. Maybe.
If I can supplement that, Mr. Chairman, it is, the purpose of this is to treat future generations the same way we've treated ourselves. The purpose is to make certain that we recognize the oil asset, that a portion of the oil asset is there in some fashion for future generations so that they can live in the same way in this state that our generation has lived in this way in the state. because we're pulling the oil out of the ground, we can't put it in reserve and say, hey, you're going to have a stream of oil out there in the future. We're simply converting it, that oil, into a financial asset, their portion of it, into a financial asset that then will sit there and generate its own revenue stream going out in the future. So we're not treating future generations any differently than we've treated ourselves. We are simply making sure that future generations are treated as well as we have treated ourselves, and that we have a sustainable, that they have the same sort of long-term sustainable source of revenue for state government that we've given ourselves.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think that the shared goal is that we look at that, and it is at the same time continuing to work on the diversification issue, knowing that the oil and gas, the reserves won't be there forever. This is a way to try to continue them into the future. At the same time, obviously, we've spent a lot of time this session talking about economic development in the state and how do we do mining and fisheries and value-added and intellectual and all sorts of other things. So I understand that this is not, you know, everybody gets to just sit back and rely on the state. I just thank you for indulging me in that.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if the presenter, if the person who is bringing the bill forward had a, or was going to make an initial presentation on the bill, but I had a question on the slides first. Right? Okay. It's on this slide dealing with the owner state, wealth of the owner state. I was wondering how the calculation for in the ground was made. Is that based on the current tax structure now? And what other assumptions were made?
The calculation basically comes from two sources. Known conventional oil, we have a forecast of future petroleum revenues from the Department of Revenue that comes out in revenue sources, and apparently a new one has come out today. That pretty much covers anticipated petroleum revenues for the next 10-year period. So I've used that document in building this up. It stops after 10 years, so you have to put in an assumption about what production will be from those known conventional sources, primarily in the North Slope between the Caney and Colville River on state lands, beyond 10 years. So I've made an assumption about decline rate. And then for other oil and gas, we don't really have any set of assumptions. So I had to build that up on my own, and I divided it into a number of categories on the basis of what kind of unconventional oil or gas they might be and the location where they might be found. So there's an assumption in there for revenues from OCS, an assumption of revenues from ANWR, NPRA, federal lands, and also assumptions about unconventional oil in the form of shale oil, unconventional oil in the form of viscous oil, unconventional oil in the form of heavy oil, as well as estimates for gas. Now, for all of these revenue sources, we're not going to see any of that revenue for at least 10 years. And with OCS, it may be 20 years from now before we see any oil. Well, if you take a revenue stream that's going to start in 20 years and you do the net present value for that revenue stream at any kind of reasonable discount rate, it gets fairly small. So the assumptions that you make about when and if and to what extent OCS development will take place are certainly important, but the in terms of their net present value, what the value of that oil in the ground is today is relatively modest. But the bottom line is that I've had to build up a lot of assumptions that don't currently really exist anywhere. And I think it's a very useful exercise, and I don't want to be the only one that's doing it. I would love to see Department of Revenue, OMB, and others take on this task as well.
Yes.
I don't know if I answered your question adequately.
I guess I appreciate that. Thank you. Through the chair, on where you got the volumes of oil and volumes of oil and gas, but where did you get the value from? What taxing regime did you use to set that net present value dollar amount?
Since DOR makes their projections of revenues from production on state lands based on certain assumptions about what the revenue structure will be, I've just taken that. And in terms of revenues from unconventional oil and gas and from production on federal lands, because the fiscal regimes are different on federal land, particularly on OCS, the state doesn't share in the production tax or the property tax or the royalties or the income tax either, and so the under current law, the state gets very little in terms of revenue from that. I guess what I'm saying is I've used the current fiscal regime and apply pretty straightforward, simple assumptions about take per barrel, knowing what the take per barrel range is for current production, recognizing that non-conventional oil is going to be more expensive to produce, maybe of lower quality. So the take per barrel is probably going to be less.
Okay, so through the chair, I mean, so it's safe to say that you use Department of Revenue figures dealing with the current tax regime to get to the point where you found roughly $90 billion net present value in the ground?
I use the Department of Revenue figures to get the $67 billion. The $22 billion is mine and mine alone.
Okay.
Because that's all production beyond the 10-year window that DOR uses.
And we are talking through the chair about, I mean, obviously we're talking, there's a big bill going through the, and it's in this committee right now dealing with lowering production tax values. That would significantly change that calculation, right?
It could. the beauty of this calculation, I think, is that it looks at revenues over the long period, not just the revenues today or revenues for 5 years or revenues for 10 years, but it looks at, in order to incorporate the impact of a tax change into this analysis, you'd want to redo the entire future revenue stream forecast, not just what it means today, but the total future revenue stream forecast, which may include enhanced revenues sometime down the road. May not. Maybe it will include enhanced revenues down the street, down the road. but it wouldn't be just how much are we losing today because of a change in tax rates that reduces revenues this year, next year, and the year after that.
I'm having trouble understanding that through the chair. That this calculation was done with the current tax structure in place, ACES, and I'm asking the question, and that the total value is currently roughly $67 billion. If we were to change the tax structure over the same period of time, wouldn't that number be a lot less?
The number could be less. The number could be more, depending on. On what the change long term is in revenues that the state would be collecting from future production.
Can I interrupt?
If you want to assume that future production is not going to change at all, then certainly the size of your calculated nest egg would be smaller.
Can I interrupt just through the chair? Representative Kawasaki, your assumption is that when ACES changes and the production decline still goes down and the reduction in tax goes down, you're assuming that production never goes up. And so what Scott's saying is that you have to assume both scenarios. You have to assume that the changes in the tax structure will actually increase production, and you have to assume that the oil prices won't go up or down. So his assumptions go both ways. You can assume that because of tax reduction, the less taxes we collect actually spurs more investment in the North Slope, our production will go up. So there could be an increase in our revenues
and
in future years.
And the chair, it could be lower, too.
Yes, we've stated that.
The other question then on the...
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The policy.
Through the chair, in the bank calculation is $60 billion. One of the proposal dealing with oil and gas tax revenues is to use some of that in the bank fund now, mm-hmm. With hopes. But that would erode the total asset that you're talking about, the $149 billion.
Any spending above the $5.5 billion erodes the value of the nest egg, whether it comes from money in the bank or from spending of petroleum revenues. The combination of those two is more than actually $6 billion, then you're eroding the value of the nest egg.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Professor Goldsmith, on page 2 of your PowerPoint. Yeah, that one. Yeah. There is an article where ConocoPhillips says that on their legacy fields, Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, they're likely not facing a 6% decline curve anymore. They're likely facing a 3% decline curve into the future.
Mm-hmm.
In your assessment of future oil revenue, are you using that 3% decline curve or what the Department of Revenue put in the revenue sources book last fall of the 6% decline curve?
What you see there on that diagram is based on Department of Revenue's fall 2012 forecast.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
Through the chair.
Representative Munoz. Representative Munoz.
Thank you.
We're going to have the tax debate later, Representative Guerra.
Chair, I had a lot of questions relevant to this.
Standardies. Representative Munoz.
I can't be a member of the committee on this bill, Mr. Chair. There's no sense me being here.
Representative Guerra. Is there a rally to go to?
No.
Representative Garrett, please don't talk when you're walking around the room. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given the recommendation or using the maximum sustained yield recommendation of $5.5 billion for FY14, then that would assume a $1.5 billion addition to savings. Is that correct? I mean, we'd have to make some serious changes immediately to implement such a new strategy. And I appreciate very much where you're going with this because I think it's very important to have discipline. But am I accurate with that?
If I may, Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay.
It's not actually 1.5 because I don't think we're now projecting 7 billion in revenues. But it's the difference
close.
Between whatever revenues are going to be in 5.5.
Right. Okay. Mr. Chairman,
yes, please.
Thank you. And then my other question is, what would our savings have to be to generate revenue sufficient to equal or to contribute to the $5.5 million contribution, given the decline rate, the current decline rate? And say within 10 years, we know that if we do nothing, we're going to be at a certain level within 10 years, a predicted level. What would what would our savings need to be to sustain whatever it is comparable to the revenue in 10 years that we'll be receiving?
For a long time, I thought around this issue in terms of how much do we need to save. You know, that's sort of the way typically you would think about question like this, but really I realize to get the answer, you have to flip the question around and say, how much can we afford to spend? And anything above what we can afford to spend, that's how much we need to save. And it's complicated because that amount that we save varies each year. It varies based upon how much petroleum revenue we're taking in, primarily, and how big our financial asset has gotten to be. So it would be nice if we could just say, okay, here's the formula for how much or what percentage we have to save each year. But and you could approximate something like that, I think, but really you need to flip it around and say, how much can we afford to spend? Anything above that we need to save.
And if I may supplement, Mr. Chairman, that simply means 5.5, anything above 5.5 billion, any revenues above 5.5 billion is what needs to go into savings. Because 5.5 billion is the sustainable level. To achieve that going forward, we need to be building the nest egg by whatever is over that.
Okay. And then just one final question.
And we're going to have about 10 more minutes tops.
Just one
for the whole meeting.
Final question on the value of the petroleum in the ground. How can you put a value and use it in a calculation when there's so much uncertainty about how and when that asset will be extracted?
Yeah, there certainly is a lot of uncertainty, and that's reflected in the fact that every time this calculation is done, you come up with a slightly different answer because of different assumptions. But this is the way, and Brad might want to comment on this. This is the way that people in the business world value assets that they own or assets that they're looking to purchase.
Quickly, if you think of the state of Alaska as a producer, which it actually is, producers routinely do the net present value of their estimated future revenue stream. That's what the SEC reports that producers give about the value of their assets are. And so we're simply looking at the state of Alaska as a producer. We're looking at the net present value of our future revenue stream and estimating it, estimating the value based upon that. Simply taking the DOR, as Scott outlined, is simply taking the DOR projections for the first 10 years and then trending them on out.
Thank you.
Next, Representative Holmes, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Costello, then Holmes. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Through the chair. I did want to mention that I really appreciate the sponsor bringing this forward and the work by Dr. Goldsmith and Mr. Keithley. I think that this is very significant, what you're proposing. And I was wondering if, Dr. Goldsmith, you would be able to provide the committee the assumptions that you used in coming up with some of these figures. Or if that's already available, if you could point us into the direction where we can find it.
Yeah, I'm certainly happy to do that. A lot of the assumptions, I think, are outlined in a document that I think I made available the last time I made a presentation, which is, Maximum Sustainable Yield, a Fiscal 2014 Update.
Thank you. Through the chair. In a nutshell, I mean, would you consider this approach to, you know, moving forward with more knowledge about our budget, a sort of a percent of market value approach where you've said, you know, this is the value of what the state has at our disposal and the, you know, we've chosen a percentage of that. And I understand, too, that the legislation doesn't require or put any hard limits on what the legislature does, which is to appropriate, but it simply provides that this information be provided to us, and then, of course, and it would change, is my understanding. I mean, if we do have changes in our economy, whether it be through diversification or other means, because each year the governor's office or the administration would be presenting this information, it would be a sort of a fluid document that's updated every year. Is that correct?
That's correct. Just like the value of our own personal assets is going to fluctuate over time for a variety of reasons. So the value of the nest egg will vary over time. And this is a method for keeping track of what that value is and how it's changing each year and how what that means for state finances.
Representative Holmes and then Osterman, and then we'll stop there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line, page 2, line 15, we're talking here about the amount, setting out the amount that's projected to be available for spending from the general fund. And I'm wondering, this is again like my principal versus balance question, should that be the amount available for spending from state assets for the following fiscal year? Because really, you know, we're basically talking about the total amount of all the assets that could be spent. Would that be, am I heading in the right direction there?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, it is. It's from the it's the UGF, so it's the amount of unrestricted general fund spending that would be that results in the sustainable number long term.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite sure that I. And obviously, you know this a lot better than I do, but I'm not sure you spent a lot more time with it. But I mean, I think the point is that this is the amount we can of state. Money that could go in, and really, you don't care whether it comes from the CBR, or the UBR, or the this or the that, or where it comes from. I mean, that's my point. Is you know, somebody could say, oh, great, well, that's. I mean, there might be a year in which, for whatever reason, something goes horribly wrong. You don't even have much UGF. You could still spend the under this projection 5.5, whether it came from the CBR. Or the So I'm just wondering whether, rather than having it say from the general fund, have it say something more like from state assets or from. State funds.
Excellent point. And it does need to reflect that it could from the CBR or the SBR. In fact, in some of the in the outer years, it will come from one of those other sources. So excellent point. That needs to be taken into account.
And the last
point. I'll hold my question.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask some questions.
Well, you can come back at another time because we're stopping the meeting because we have to schedule our next meeting's bills. We said we were going to. Go so far. You want to hold everybody here?
Sure, I don't want to hold everybody here.
Stand at ease. We have our intent is to set this bill aside, and it will be chaired. This committee has discussion on fiscal policy. We have a subcommittee. It will be chaired by Representative Costello. Representative Austin, we are a member. Representative Holmes is a member. Representative Thompson and Representative Guerra. The discussion will continue throughout. This is far. This is not an item that we are going to. We are going to have any resolution of today, as the sponsor was aware, and you know, we could get into all kinds of rabbit trails and other issues and trying to make the high markings or whatever points. But we have heard the presentation from the two distinguished gentlemen, had robust rounds of questions around, of which I didn't participate in deference to others, other than just declarative points as we went through their discussion. So. There will be a lot of discussion throughout the interim, continuing this body's discussion of fiscal policy issues. So that's the subcommittee. Representative Millett Millett. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I've heard another name in the media a lot. And Representative Millett, and I will also participate in the committee. And of course, everybody will be invited, as in all fiscal policy issues, to. to participate. So we're setting this bill aside, but expressing our commitment to continuing a robust discussion of this issue.
Mr. Chair, having nothing to do with today, there are a number of bills I'd like to be on a subcommittee on, but this is not one that I would prefer to be on if that's the will of the chair. I'll serve on it if you'd like.
We recognize your length of service. You're a hard worker, Representative Guerra, when we have a lot more time, we are much more anxious to hear a lot of the sometimes lengthy but always thought-provoking questions, and sometimes even statements. But we really need to, the chairman and I really need to make sure that we turn in our calendar of the next couple of days to the clerk to serve the public process. So we don't usually discuss our process here. That is our goal to end this. We had talked about a one-hour presentation where I'm glad we spent as much time on it as we did, and folks had a chance to go around the table. So,
Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing this bill. I appreciate the subcommittee, and I appreciate the thoughtfulness of doing it over interim. I think we'll be able to educate the public a lot better and have a lot of more buy-in, especially from not only this committee but the rest of our House and brothers on the other side. So thank you very much for hearing this. I really appreciate it.
And thank you to the two gentlemen who came down from Anchorage to participate in this. And the chairman and I really need to work to get our schedule up for next week. Now it's 24 hours. So with that, we stand in adjournment.